Hello and welcome to South Asia Chat, a podcast brought to you by the Institute of South Asian Studies at the National University of Singapore. I'm your host today, Claudia Chia, a research analyst at the Institute. Here at South Asia Chat today, we are going to discuss how China's Belt and Road Initiative have evolved since its conception 10 years ago and its presence in the South Asian region. It is with my pleasure to be joined in this episode by Dr. Amar Malik, Senior Research Scientist at 8Data, where he leads the Chinese Development Finance Program. Welcome to today's episode, Dr. Malik.
Thank you very much, Claudia. Really glad to be here.
Since President Xi Jinping launched the BRI in September 2013, the Global Infrastructure Development Strategy has been a focus of many contemporary studies on China. Many professionals and academics likewise have looked into a number of issues surrounding the sources of funding, project viability, accusations of tricking countries into debt traps, and the implications of domestic elite capture. Despite the occasional criticisms, the BRI remains attractive to many countries in need of development financing and investment. As of January 2023, 151 countries have signed up. So in your view, Dr. Malik, what are some notable changes in the BRI over the last 10 years?
I think to answer your question, Claudia, I'll take you a little bit back. We at 8Data have been capturing Chinese development finance activities since the year 2000. And when we first noticed the big increases in Chinese development financing, it actually started happening around the time of the global financial crisis of 2008-2009. It was around that time that Chinese policy banks, I'm talking about CDB as well as China Exim Bank, they started moving funds out of US treasuries, which were now suddenly giving lower returns than ever before due to lower interest rates and quantitative easing in the United States. And they started pumping these funds into infrastructure projects around the world. By the time President Xi announced the Belt and Road Initiative, a lot of developing countries had their balance sheets full of large-scale infrastructure projects that had been given out to the ministries of finance. So there was a lot of sovereign debt. What we saw in and around 2013 was that Chinese creditors became more creative and started coming up with new ways of providing this financing, especially in the form of special purpose vehicles and joint ventures, in which the typical model is to create a shell company that receives the funding. There is someone, there's also a equity component involved. It could be 80-20 in favor of debt, or it could be 70-30 in favor of debt. And then the company executes the project, and then the project moves forward on that basis. Now, that trend had continued in a major way for several years until the coming of the COVID crisis. And what we've seen now is that as more and more of these big ticket infrastructure projects have become due for repayments, because remember, each of these projects has a 5 to 6 years, sometimes longer, grace period before which payments are not due by borrowers. Now that all of these payments are coming through, it's unfortunately happening at a time when global interest rates have increased, and a lot of these projects are given out, or loans are given out with variable interest rates. So their repayment amounts have become much larger, and a lot of countries around the world are facing debt distress. And because of all of these factors, I think China now faces a major challenge at the 10-year mark of the Belt and Road Initiative, where a lot of their creditors or borrowers are having trouble repaying the loans that they had taken some years ago. So I think that's the high-level overview of what's been happening in the Belt and Road Initiative over the last few years.
Oh, great. Yeah, thank you for the very insightful analysis into the different ventures that started since the global financial crisis in 2008. So now, as Xi is leading in his third term, are there any new directions or initiatives under the BRI? And also, we noticed that he launched a new global security initiative. So in your view, is there anything that complement or deviate from the BRI under this new initiative?
As I mentioned earlier, during the first 5 or 6 years of the Belt and Road era, we saw really large-scale infrastructure projects being financed by various Chinese entities. China now outspends the US by a more than 2-to-1 basis, and most of that growth in development financing has come in the form of loans, concessional loans, rather than grants. In this backdrop, and as countries face more and more debt distress and have trouble repaying the loans that they had taken out in the first few years of the BRI, China has now started making a major pivot. And the pivot is now toward short-term lending, or what we could call bailouts. So, typical model that China has followed is to have the PBOC, the Central Bank of China, engage in these instruments, which are called credit swaps, in which developing countries can take lines of credit and use them in their hour of need. And we have also seen Chinese state-owned commercial banks like ICBC, and as well as Chinese policy banks, making large deposits into the central banks of developing country partners like Argentina and like Pakistan, either to shore up their foreign exchange reserves to give them more stability and meet their financing needs, or to help them repay the loans that they had taken out earlier as part of the Belt and Road Initiative. So I would say that a major shift that has taken place in the last couple of years, I would say, since COVID, is that China is now entering into this business of providing rescue lending to countries who are in fiscal distress. And this begs the question of how and when China will coordinate with the International Monetary Fund. Just earlier this week or last week, the International Director of PBOC made a public statement in which he said that China will continue to support the IMF's initiatives to try to work with countries who are in fiscal distress and to support the multilateral system. But he insisted that the haircuts or the adjustments that need to be made will should be made by all bilateral creditors and multilateral creditors at the same time, not just by China. So it seems to me that Chinese approach is to promote multilaterals and to try to come up with ways in which they can work with the IMF, whose job at the end of the day is to be the lender of last resort and to introduce reforms that are needed for countries in distress to fix their houses. As far as the Global Security Initiative is concerned, this is just one of three initiatives that China has launched in recent months, the other ones being Global Development Initiative and then Global Civilization Initiative, which came out recently. And all of these appear to me to be very conceptual and focusing on the principles that Global South countries have always presented, which is, faith in the multilateral system, equal treatment, and these sorts of ideals that countries like India, Indonesia, Pakistan, Brazil, all these global South powers have been advocating for years, and they see the world as being inherently in an imbalance with the Western countries basically dominating the entire system. So I think this might be an indication of China's desire in the future to use its large global influence, which it has built by the Belt and Road Initiative and other things, to try to change the institutional mechanism by which the world is run, i.e. the Bretton Woods institutions and the way that they do their business. So it's early days for these initiatives, but I think it's another pivot that China is trying to make in order to change the scope of its global influence around the world.
All right, just now you mentioned that the Global South countries historically and even in contemporary, that's all share the same value of faith in multilateral systems and also equal respect in the dealing of foreign policies and economic policies as well. So now that we bring BRI closer to the South Asian region, how do you think the reception of BRI have evolved in different parts of South Asia over the last 10 years?
The flagship of the entire BRI, as you know, is the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor. And the story of China-Pakistan Economic Corridor is a story of energy and transport infrastructure. I would say that two-thirds of BRI or CPEC spending has been in the energy sector. And China made major investments in Pakistan's energy infrastructure in 2013. The idea was that, in fact, this is written in stone and signed by both governments, and they have a long-term strategic point plan, sorry, in which the first phase would entail the provision of large-scale infrastructure that would help solve Pakistan's underlying economic challenges. That is, the issues that make Pakistan's economy less competitive, than it could be. So that phase is pretty much over. China has already built out large amounts of power production and transmission capacity. China has increased Pakistan's highway network quite dramatically. And moving from cities like Karachi to Lahore, upcountry, or Islamabad, that travel time has been reduced quite a lot, sometimes 40, 50%. So those kinds of early harvest projects, as they're called, were materialized. But in the second phase, according to this long-term plan, Chinese industry was going to make use of these facilities by relocating manufacturing facilities in textile and technology and cell phones and electronics into the special economic zones that Pakistan has created. And the situation right now is that even though the special economic zones exist, there really hasn't been much activity in terms of investment because the environment that investors need to be in a special economic zone is not available. They need workforce, they need safety and security. They also need clustering of economic activity. That is, they require supply chains to be around them. And because of political uncertainty in Pakistan, there has not been much attention paid to this issue, in my view, and Pakistan has failed to materialize on the second phase of the Belt and Road that was going to be the benefit. And of course, the third phase, which seems more distant today than ever before, the idea was that this kind of industrialization would create widespread prosperity by job creation at a large scale in Pakistan, and we'll see Pakistan become more developed. That is the story of China-Pakistan economic corridor. What China has done, however, ADATA's research has recently documented this, that since 2018 alone, China has given Pakistan something like $23 billion in short-term liquidity injections, which, again, going back to the point that I was making earlier, a large part of this is to rescue their own banks and financial institutions which have invested in Pakistan. And Pakistan is pretty much in a dire financial situation right now, and the Chinese side hasn't come through in a big way. But behind the scenes, I think they're playing a positive role in trying to keep Pakistan's fiscal situation floating in a way that the IMF could come and restore the program that Pakistan is in. On the Indian side, of course, since the skirmishes that took place at the border between India and China, my sense is that the relations between the two countries have deteriorated. There's also been India's participation in the Quad, in the Indo-Pacific Alliance, that has further made relations between the two sides more challenging. I keep an eye on the Indian media, and I certainly feel that the tone toward China and Chinese activities and the Belt and Road has become more difficult. And then, of course, there's Sri Lanka, which has Chinese debt, but it is a small proportion of the overall problem. And there, I think we have to keep a very close eye to see how Chinese creditors interact with the Sri Lankan authorities as well as the IMF to see if they would bail out Sri Lanka in their hour of need.
Okay, so earlier there's a very interesting point you mentioned about how the current investment in phase two in Pakistan have unfortunately not been able to materialize much due to the security environment and the threat of attack. So from my end, what I understand is that Pakistan does provide a special division forces to protect CPEC projects and its workers. So what has been the impact of increasing attacks on Chinese nationals within the country? Are there any concerns or protections in restive areas like Balochistan? And would these restive areas be a priority for the development of China-Pakistan bilateral relations?
Yeah, I think it's a very important question. Pakistan did take this extraordinary step of providing unprecedented level of security to the Pakistani to Chinese nationals in operating in Pakistan. However, in the last few years, there's been a spate of high-profile attacks against Chinese interests. Especially in 2021, there was an attack in northern Pakistan at the place called Dasu, right next to a hydropower plant, where I think nine Chinese engineers were killed. And after that, China announced a suspension of construction activity on the site. The Pakistani Prime Minister visited the Chinese embassy, and there were some angry statements that came out of China. And it is also because Pakistan had initially said that this attack was not a terrorist attack, and it could be an accident or something else, where the Chinese side insisted that this was indeed a terrorist attack. So this was really the first occasion that I have seen over the last many years that China and Pakistan have publicly been in a tense, I shouldn't say standoff, but a disagreement in public over what transpired in Dasu. But since then, because of repeated assurances by the Pakistani security establishment, I believe, activities have been restored. I think Chinese nationals are now under greater vigilance, and they are trying their best to stay safe and follow security protocols. And the Pakistani state thinks that it is in their interest to protect Chinese nationals. My understanding is that because a lot of these big infrastructure projects have been built out, the sheer volume of Chinese nationals in staying in Pakistan has come down, but there are still, by my estimate, several thousand of them staying all over Pakistan in camps, around construction sites, in cities. You see them everywhere. So I think that security threat will persist, and it will remain a cloud that hangs over China-Pakistan relations. Having said that, it is also quite incredible that despite these attacks, and this thing that we've documented around 45 attacks where Chinese interests have been explicitly targeted since 2021, and many deaths that have happened at this time period, China has remained committed to delivering on the promises that it made to Pakistan as part of the CPEC. And I think that reflects the strategic importance that China associates with Pakistan, given Pakistan's location, neighboring India, being close to the Persian Gulf, as well as the special sort of relationship that CPEC has within the Belt and Road. It's always referred to as the flagship of the Belt and Road Initiative. So in some ways, the portfolio of projects in Pakistan itself is too big to fail for China, I think. But it's also the case that China wants CPEC to succeed because it is important to prove to the world that their model of Belt and Road is actually going to be successful.
Thank you for the analysis of the bilateral relations with regards to the security situation. Now I am down to my last question. So if we zoom out a bit and we look at Pakistan-China relations in the arena of international politics, I noted that there's reports of Pakistan declining to join the US-led democracy summit due to the fear of recognizing China. So in light of this, and also in your opinion, do you think that the China and Pakistan bilateral relations is so strong that it can tie and influence Pakistan's policies towards the US?
That's a great question. I think this is probably a clear indication that it is having an effect on Pakistan's views toward the United States. However, I've seen that we had a change of government in Pakistan in April of last year, and the previous government of Imran Khan, when they were going out, they came up with this accusation that the vote of no confidence against them that was responsible for their ouster was actually instigated by the United States. Whether or not that's actually true, whether or not the evidence actually backs it up, I think it's safe to assume that many people in Pakistan, if not the majority of people in Pakistan, actually believe that narrative. So this government, which is led jointly by a coalition of several partners, and under the leadership of the new foreign minister, Bulawal Bhutto Zardari, they have been trying to do some course correction. I think also behind the scenes, Pakistan's military, which is also an influential player in foreign policy, I think they're also trying to make a course correction, and to make sure that Pakistan can maintain a balance between the two countries. This decision of not being in the Democracy Summit, I'm told that this was a hotly debated issue for several days. They kept debating this internally. But I think at the end of the day, they did not, they made a calculation that the returns from participation in this summit will not outweigh the benefits. And so therefore they decided not to go. I think it's a pretty clear indication of where Pakistan's foreign policy alignment will be. And there's a very strong lobby in Pakistan, which is advocating for Pakistan to look eastward, But then on the other hand, there's another lobby which says we must maintain relations with the West. So it will be very interesting to see how Pakistan behaves in its foreign policy into the future as the US-China relationship gets more and more acrimonious, for a back for lack of a better word. But it is also true that when a Pakistani policymaker looks at the world, they look at the United States being very closely aligned with India. In the Indo-Pacific region, the US being disengaged from Central Asia and Afghanistan, and also a dwindling or a reduced US role in the Middle East, with China coming in and brokering this new deal between Saudi Arabia and Iran. And it gives more weight to the argument that Pakistan should continue to tighten its relationship with China and to follow in under China's leadership and in this new emerging global world order.
I suppose that we will see more Pakistan and China interactions at this year-end SCO meeting as well, and maybe more developments will come from there. First and foremost, I have to thank you a lot for sharing your insightful thoughts with us today, Dr. Malik. I have learned a lot, and I'm sure our listeners as well, about the last decade of the BRI and the China-Pakistan bilateral relationship. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you very much, Claudia. It's always great to talk to people at NUS, which is also my alma mater. And so it's very nice to talk to you, and I hope this conversation was helpful. Thank you so much.
Yes, it really is. With that, we come to the end of today's episode. You were listening to South Asia Chat. To learn more about our work, visit us at isas.nus.edu.sg. You can also get updates from us on Twitter, LinkedIn, Facebook, and Instagram.